could be sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading more from Heaven for Beginners, Betsy Holloway's reminiscences of her life growing up in Durham. Resuming in Chapter 8, Downtown, we're finding out about the children's room, built around 1930, in the new public library that was started in 1921. So you could enter the children's room in the basement without going through the main library on the first floor, your mother turned off Main Street into the driveway and let you out at the outside concrete steps, after which she either drove on back to wait under the trees in the parking lot that held 6 cars, or else left you to your own happy devices and returned home. The children's room held several low tables surrounded by child-sized wooden chairs, together with a circulation desk and card catalog that were likewise comfortably low. A small magazine section just inside the door contained Calling All Girls, Nature Magazine, Jack and Jill, The American Girl, and Boy's Life. The walls were lined 5 feet high with books. A warm and inviting place, the room always had a vaguely pleasant smell all its own, a mixture of old books, new magazines, library paste, wet wool mittens drying on the radiator, and the librarian's English lavender cologne. What I read at the library was less remarkable than what I didn't read. In the latter category languished books on radio, stamps, coins, stars, maps, clocks, rocks, trees, rivers, oceans, dinosaurs, wild flowers, birds, snakes, dogs, horses, shells, fish, the human body, electricity, roads, airplanes, autos, government, sports, and science. What remained, though, I read over and over again. The fairy tales, Howard Pyle's Wonder Clock, and Andrew Lang's Blue Fairy Book, Grimm and Andersen, and Granny's Wonderful Chair, stories about dolls that could think and talk and sometimes walk, whose owners loved them into life, or who found themselves aboard great sailing ships, or abducted by crows, or rescued by mice, books about children in faraway lands who wore wooden shoes or silk kimonos and spoke strange languages, Ho Ming and Little Pear and Young Fu, Nils and Hans Brinker and Heidi, all the Dr. Doolittle stories, and any other books about animals in which the librarian could assure me nothing sad happened, not Black Beauty or Bambi, naturally, but stories about pet penguins that performed military drills, and a toad that pursued the life adventurous, and a small white cat named Good Fortune that received Buddha's own blessing. And there were books about magic amulets, silver bears and Chinese kittens, and books about real children who had enchanted adventures in the heavens, or under the sea, or in the children's country, and books about proper English children, Pauline and Petrova and Posy studying ballet, the Bastables seeking treasure and forming a society for being good in, and angelic Sarah Crewe, rescued at last from her pinched, miserable existence at Miss Minchin's, when her true identity was made known to the wealthy Indian gentleman next door. The children's room had a small but steady group of the faithful who came in to borrow books all year long, but traffic became really brisk early in the summer, when Vacation Reading Club began. Each of us who joined was assigned a construction paper bookshelf with our name on it, and whenever we finished a book, we notified the librarian, who thereupon sat down with us at one of the low tables to query us on the volume's contents. If our answers failed to satisfy her, she would suggest, gently but firmly, that we take our book back home to review before we again presented ourselves for examination. But If we replied adequately and correctly, she added to our shelf a colored strip of paper on which she'd lettered the book's title. A poster on the bulletin board listed all our names, each one followed by stars indicating how many books that child had read so far. A blue star for each book except for the fifth, which received a silver star, and the tenth, a gold. Vacation reading club ended when school started, but in October Mrs. Pridgen arranged a special program during which a librarian first explained to us the importance of reading and then announced the names of Watts Street's vacation readers. As she called out names, we filed importantly to the front of the auditorium to receive diplomas for participating in the club, together with our book-filled construction paper bookcases and an invitation to join again next year. For 7 years, I paid my weekly and sometimes semi-weekly visits to the children's room, until at 12 I graduated to the adult collection upstairs. Actually, you were supposed to be 14 before you gained access to the adult area, but after listening to several weeks of pleading, my mother consulted with Miss Crawford, pointing out that I was in the 9th grade and therefore reading on a 14-year-old level. After some thought, Miss Crawford judiciously decreed that a card might be issued me, but advised my mother to keep an eye on my selection of reading materials, since the library did possess some books that were, as she delicately termed it, intended for mature readers. Managing the main circulation desk throughout the years I used the library was Miss Sophronia Webb, an attractive but solemn woman who wore horn-rimmed glasses and had short, dark, curly hair. In keeping with the dignity of the library, Miss Webb nearly always wore a correct gabardine or seersucker jacket and a skirt with a conservatively ruffled white blouse, and in all the years I saw her we never exchanged a word beyond my murmured "thank you" after she'd stamped the date due slips in my books, and her pleasant but succinct whispered response, "You're welcome." For a few days after becoming an adult reader, I drifted uncertainly back and forth between my familiar, well-loved children's room and the untried territory of the main floor young people's section, until I could get a mental grip on the new area and discover which books there were the good ones. Soon they began to emerge. Here were all the Sue Barton books, encompassing vivacious red-haired Sue's training and entire professional career from student nurse through superintendent of nurses to visiting nurse, including the time she courageously prevented a delirious Spanish patient's escape through a window while she herself was recovering from an emergency appendectomy. The entire hospital staff was awed by her selfless bravery. Dr. Poston himself came in to thank her, and even Miss Cameron, the probationer's stern instructor, offered grudging praise. Best friends Betsy, Tacy, and Tib grew up together in a world that smelled of roses. Penny Parrish floated happily through a summer of horse shows, military dances, and moonlight picnics, and soon I plunged eagerly into the heady teenage world of proms, taffeta evening dresses, convertibles, joy and heartbreak that resided in Class Ring and 17th Summer. About the same time, I developed a compelling interest in teenage advice books, which advised me to wash out my girdle every night, always to examine the inside seams of a garment before buying it, and not to monopolize the telephone. I also learned that the first and last dances belonged to my escort, that when ordering in a restaurant I must appear uncertain of what I wanted and urge my date to order first, so as to get an idea of how much money he could spend, and that I could draw a silent date into animated conversation by introducing topics that interested him. "Exactly how does the split T formation work, Steve?" The likelihood of my encountering such taxing social situations seemed remote when the mirror on the wall revealed lank, dishwater blonde hair, near-sighted eyes framed by thick pink plastic-rimmed glasses, and a figure that possessed all the allure of a board. Still, the ugly duckling offered some encouragement, and I did read John Robert Power's Secrets of Charm in the Herald 3 times a week. In case a sudden transformation should sweep me into a dizzying whirl of popularity, it was wise to be prepared. By 10:15, I'd picked out the books I wanted, after Miss Webb had checked them out I descended the library's stone steps to Main Street and turned right, past the First Presbyterian Church and heading west towards downtown. To the east was the Trailways station, where my mother and I returned from our trips to Raleigh. Across from the bus station stood Sears, occupying the spacious building that had been constructed soon after the war. Across the street from the church stood the Astor Theater, previously the Ellis, and before that the State, the Russell, and, when it opened in 1935, the New Theater. It now showed mostly double features of third-time returned films. Next to the Astor stood the Durham County Health Department, where my father and I went early each June to get our typhoid shots before swimming season began. My mother was exempt from this duty because once, years before, she had reacted adversely to a typhoid shot and nearly died. On the corner, as I crossed Roxborough Street, stood the Malborn Hotel, once one of the handsomest and best equipped in the South. Since the war, though, the hotel had fallen into the yellow leaf and now catered, rumor had it, to a somewhat irregular clientele. Just past the Malborn, and across the street from the YMCA and its splendid neighbor, the county's four-story neoclassical revival courthouse, stood the old Orpheum Theater, now renamed the Rialto. Half a block west of the theater, at the corner of Church and Main, I passed the Fashion. Be sure it's a fashion, which sold the very best lines of women's clothing, and where for years Mrs. Gladys Smoke presided firmly over most of the society weddings in town. Favored brides confided proudly, Mrs. Smoke is doing 3 weddings on the 16th, but she's coming to ours. After the Uptown Theater, formerly the Paramount, and before that the Paris, came one of the more popular downtown restaurants, Harvey's Cafeteria. Their food was excellent, but the restaurant was usually crowded by businessmen and women, and I seldom went inside. A few steps more brought me to the busy corner of Main and Mangum Streets, where I considered real downtown began. After checking Walgreens for new Captain Marvels and Supermans, I crossed the street to Cress's and headed straight for the candy counter to review their offerings, which were always the same: silver-wrapped chocolate kisses, sugared orange jelly slices, chocolate wafers covered with white sprinkles, jelly beans, orange-flavored peanuts, and kernel fresh cashews and pecans in heated glass cases. Holiday seasons did offer additional choices. For Easter, colored candy eggs and chocolate bunnies, yellow marshmallow chicks and rabbits. For Christmas, hard ribbon candy, mellow cream Santas, and peppermint candy canes. After standing ritually for a few seconds in front of each case, I generally ended up buying a quarter of a pound of corn candy for 10 cents, and then I had something to nibble on while I went back to gaze at the goldfish in their glass tanks. Most of the time I just stood there watching them swim around, but about once a year one of our fish at home died, and then I could buy a replacement. When I'd picked out the liveliest and healthiest-looking one, the sales clerk filled a small, wire-handled, white cardboard carton with water, used a tiny net to capture my fish, managing miraculously to catch the very one I'd chosen out of the nearly identical dozens that swam in the tank, and deposited him gently inside the carton. Then, of course, I had to take him with me everywhere I went for the rest of the day, to lunch and a movie, as well as on the bus trip home. But it was worth it, I thought, to give him a glass bowl of his very own where he could swim lazily through a towered ceramic castle for entertainment, and have another goldfish for a friend. From Cress's I went past Butler's Shoes to Baldwin's, the store of specialized shops, which offered gifts, clothing, and a good book department where you could check out the latest fiction for 2 cents a day. This was a fairly expensive luxury, and only rarely did I take advantage of it, but I did prefer to borrow my racier reading, Forever Amber and Never Love a Stranger, there rather than at the library, where Miss Webb tended to wrinkle her usually serene brow in a small worried frown when I brought such titles to the desk. From Baldwin's, I jaywalked back across the street to look in the window at Cannon, Red Goose, Shoes, before passing Connolly's Jewelers, with a quick glance at their silver and china window display. From there I trotted busily on past My Shop Ladies Ready-to-Wear, Roscoe Griffin's Shoe Store, and Van Straten's, to make a quick stop in Silver's 5 cents to $1 store, with its basement grocery where downtown employees frequently shopped after work. Sometimes I crossed back to inspect the silver patterns in the window of Jones and Frazier, which presented a teaspoon in one's chosen pattern to each girl who graduated from Durham High. It would take me 6 years to make my choice. On to Eckerd Drugs, with its sweet smells of arpège, heaven scent, and aquamarine lotion. And finally, my next stop, F. W. Woolworth. Woolworth's was the best store on the whole block. A sign at the front door, above the tiled W, urged, "Visit Woolworth's Luncheonette." And usually, I did that first, before the crowd rushed in at noon. You could buy a hot dog with coleslaw and chili, with a Coke, for 15 cents. Occasionally, if I were really hungry and had 30 cents, I ordered a hamburger and chocolate milkshake instead. As soon as I could hurry through my lunch and leave my nickel for the waitress, I started purposefully down the aisles to survey the long, waist-high counters filled with merchandise. Tangie Natural and Pink Queen lipsticks, Pond's Cold Cream, Coty Face Powder, Maybelline Cake Mascara, Orange and Yellow Fiesta Wear, Figurines in 18th Century Dress, Aunt Jemima Salt and Pepper Shakers, an assortment of ashtrays. The most popular style had a fire hydrant, next to which stood a dog with lifted leg, and vases elaborately decorated with flowers and gold trim, made in occupied Japan. Endless artificial flowers, jewelry, dresser sets, and hair accessories, from snoods to Minnie Mouse plastic barrettes. Rows of picture frames containing glamorous photographs of Vivian Leigh, Claudette Colbert, Clark Gable, and Ida Lupino. One whole counter held school supplies, Blue Horse notebooks and paper, Number 2 pencils, Esterbrook fountain pens, and Scrip ink, and sturdy belted canvas book sacks in blue, brown, and green. The toy department offered dolls by the dozen, a few of them black, babies in long gowns, little girls in dimity, an occasional boy doll in cotton sunsuit or corduroy overalls, and, every little girl's dream, the bride dolls in white satin and lace, carefully packaged in boxes with cellophane on top, so they could be admired in all their glory without being touched. On a smaller scale, you could buy tiny 2-inch-long pink plastic dolls with movable arms and legs, and a dollhouse full of miniature furniture for them. Plastic dining room tables and chairs, wooden radios, refrigerators, and bookcases with books inside. You could find any kind of yo-yo you wanted, from elaborately packaged grand champions down through more utilitarian and inexpensive models, each one accompanied by instructions for walking the dog and going round the world. There were Mickey Mouse banks and hinged 6-piece wooden snakes that convulsively reversed themselves when you folded over the top section, jump ropes, black and white Scotty magnets, and slinkies, bubble pipes, amber glass piggy banks, and Monopoly sets. Penn Railroad, $200. New golden books offered stories about Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny, Andy Panda and the Katzenjammer Kids. Big Little books related Dick Tracy's struggles with mad killers, and Flash Gordon's adventures on Mongo. There were dozens of comics, Patsy Walker, The Marvel Family, Superman, Archie, Little Lulu, Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, as well as Betty Grable and Princess Elizabeth paper dolls, Elizabeth Taylor and Carmen Miranda coloring books. For 39 cents, you could buy the inexpensively bound Whitman editions, brown, green, or blue leatherette, that offered classics from Little Women to Treasure Island, as well as dozens of mystery and adventure stories featuring comic strip characters and movie stars of the day, from Blondie and Dagwood's Snapshot Clue to Judy Garland and the Hoodoo Costume. And when I was 10, Al Capp's Schmooze appeared, and nearly as soon as those cuddly animals had marched out of the Valley of the Schmoon to offer themselves to mankind, they sprang up in dozens of guises throughout Woolworth's, in books, in plastic replicas of all sizes, and on almost everything else, from jewelry to ashtrays, balloons to penny banks. Schmooze were lovable, bewhiskered, ham-shaped white animals, about 2 feet high, Broiled, their meat tasted like steak. Fried, like chicken. They supplied endless amounts of milk, eggs, and butter. Their hide made the finest leather, or cloth, depending on how thick you sliced it. Their eyes made splendid suspender buttons. Their whiskers, excellent toothpicks. They ate nothing and multiplied rapidly. If you looked at one hungrily, he dropped dead of sheer joy, but two others immediately appeared to take his place. And, if you wanted to have a picnic, you rode the schmooze to the picnic grounds, ate your fill, and rode the uneaten ones back home. By now, laden with library books and dime store purchases, I left Woolworth's and walked past the dignified Italianate Fidelity Bank, where I had $14.30 in savings, to turn down Corcoran Street, past the seated group of black women waiting patiently for customers to buy their bright bouquets of zinnias for 50 cents, and then across the street to look in the windows at Ellis Stone, Durham's best store since 1886. Here were sophisticated mannequins, smartly dressed in well-tailored handmacker wool suits and holding poodle cloth toppers, or else enveloped in yards of tulle and standing beside a small, discreet sign reading, "Fascinating Formals, $29.95 and up." Ellis Stone had in 1938 left its former location next to Woolworth's to occupy the lower floors of the Hill Building, a 17-story Art Moderne skyscraper that had replaced the old post office. From Ellis Stone I continued down Corcoran to the Washington Duke Hotel, where, adopting the dignified mien that I thought suited the hotel's grandeur, I entered through the revolving door, crossed the lobby, and hoped people thought I was a paying guest as I climbed the carpeted stairs to visit the mezzanine ladies' room. From the Washington Duke, I crossed the street to Thomas Mook's store, where the saleswomen not only recognized me but also knew I never bought anything, so that I was greeted politely and then left to browse undisturbed. Thomas's offered scrapbooks, diaries, writing paper, greeting cards, and office supplies, together with a gift department that sparkled with crystal vases, music boxes, and porcelain lamps. The hobby and craft section contained Chinese checkers, jigsaw puzzles, and a generous selection of color-coded canvases with which you could paint the picture of your choice, from an anonymous but splendid horse to Da Vinci's Last Supper. But for me, the main attraction was in the rear of the store. Aside from the library, Thomas Bookstore had the best young people's book department in town. All the series were there. Not even the library offered most of these, possibly considering their mass popularity beneath its dignity. The younger children's books, The Bobbsey Twins, Maida, and Honey Bunch. The clever, cool-headed, courageous sleuths, Nancy Drew, Judy Bolton, and Connie Blair. The dedicated nurses, Sue Barton and Cherry Ames, along with L. M. Montgomery's romantic Anne stories, the Betsy Tacy and Penny Parrish books, and Pollyanna, the Glad Girl. The Dr. Doolittle books were there as well, together with Janice Meredith, What Katie Did, The Secret Garden, most of the books I loved, and dozens more I hadn't read. Every week I coveted those books. They were expensive, though, $1.50 each, sometimes more, and always I left with only my library books and my dime store purchases. But when I was in the 8th grade, our school librarian, Miss Whitmore, announced a book contest. A dozen or so of us picked up a sheet of questions about books and authors, looked up the answers, and turned in our entries to be judged. A few days later, Miss Whitmore announced that Anne Maxwell had won first prize, a gift certificate worth $3 at Thomas Bookstore. I had won second, a $2 certificate. The following Saturday, prize firmly in hand, I allowed myself an hour to make my choice. Promptly, a difficulty arose. What I wanted was not one book, but all of them. Faced with the necessity of limiting my selection, I reluctantly began the painful process of elimination. I'd long since outgrown the Bobbsey Twins and Honey Bunch. All the Betsy Tacy, Penny Parrish, and Sue Barton books were in the library. My parents gave me Nancy Drew's and Judy Bolton's for Christmas and birthdays. But the shelves held dozens of others to look at, cherish in hand, and long for. And at last, Overcome with frustrated indecision, I strayed desperately into the adult section, spotted a copy of the store's previous Sunday Herald ad listing new arrivals, and picked up a novel from the list. The book's dust jacket reported that Raising a Riot related the hilarious experiences of a man who, during his wife's hospitalization, had suddenly been forced to keep house, buy groceries, and care for his children. This was clearly an idea to tickle anyone's funny bone, and I was sold. Having made my choice, I took the book and my gift certificate to a saleswoman, who seemed astonished that I was actually making a purchase. Proudly, I bore the volume out of the store in a pink-striped Thomas Book Store bag. That evening, and the next day, I read it through, giggling over the absurdities implicit in the notion of a man's cooking and keeping house. After I'd finished, I placed the book carefully in my bookcase, alongside my Nancy Drew's, and the next Saturday I was looking yearningly at Thomas's young people's books, right on schedule. Occasionally, my routine varied. Once in a while, I lunched on chicken chow mein and almond cookies at the Oriental, or else on stuffed peppers and carrot raisin salad at the cupboard cafeteria, which stood conveniently close to Thomas Bookstore. Some Saturdays were dental appointment days, and then I nervously took the elevator up to the 9th floor in the Hill Building to have genial, handsome Dr. Willis clean my teeth or fill a cavity, while Miss Parrish held rolls of cotton in my mouth and admonished me gently when the drill hurt and my only recourse was to bite down on her finger. If my mother needed stamps, or I had an overseas friendship kit to mail, I went to the columned post office behind the center theater, where I could gaze reverently at the high ceilings, bronze light fixtures, and marble floors as I waited in line at the window. Sometimes I shopped at Belk's, close to Five Points, where I looked at chambray or piqué dresses, or visited the basement to have new rubber taps put on my loafers, keeping my eyes down as I waited, in the hope that no one I knew would see me waiting in my stocking feet, or stopped by the shoe department to study my feet in the X-ray machine. A few years later, Belk's would install Durham's first escalator, the store's pride of ownership doubtless dimmed by those of us who persisted in trying to climb the down escalator when we thought no one was looking. Roses 5 and 10 stood across the street from Belk's, and for lunch I could go either to the White Way Lunch in the Piedmont Building, or else around the corner to Amos and Andy, where each day Norris Eubanks served dozens of the best hot dogs in town. Occasionally, during rush hours, he entertained his customers by showily lining one arm from shoulder to palm with rolls that he then filled nimbly with hot dogs and condiments, never spilling a drop. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.